You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is a live broadcast, the first after our five-day conference at the Thunder Horse Ranch, Jeff Duvall's Thunder Horse Ranch. What an incredible week. And, you know, I don't even know how to tell you about our conference week. It was held on Jeff Duvall's ranch, Thunder Horse Ranch. Jeff is quite a guy. He's a personal friend of mine. And that's the place where I take the family when we just want to go and get away from everybody and everything and just let our hair down and relax. Jeff's been teaching Pooh how to be a first-class, top-notch horsewoman for over a year now. And she's at the point where she is riding Jeff's Arabian Stallion Pohono, standing up in the saddle, arms straight out from her sides, not holding anything, at a trot. And that's quite an achievement for a, well, just turned 8-year-old little girl. She just turned 8 on Saturday. So we're all excited about that. She had her birthday party at the ranch, and it was just a lot of fun. Let me tell you about Jeff and Thunder Horse Ranch so you'll know the setting where we were at and the type of people that we were with. Jeff comes from a banking family, a wealthy banking family. He lived most of his life in South America and in the Caribbean Ocean. He is fluent in Spanish, as you could well imagine, having been reared in mostly Spanish-speaking countries. Jeff loves horses, has loved horses all of his life. And most of his adult life has been involved with horses, teaching people how to ride horses, taking care of horses, serving as a wrangler, grooming horses, breeding horses, you name it, and Jeff has done it. I've never met anyone in my life who knows more about horses than Jeff. He may not know more than anyone else, but I've never seen anyone who knows more than him. I've also never seen anyone who loves horses as much as Jeff does and who displays it openly and unabashedly anytime he's around horses. It's obvious to anyone who watches him that Jeff is in love with these animals. And it's incredible to see how he handles them and how they respond to his every wish, it seems. Well, Jeff was living in the Paradise Valley of Nevada several years ago. It wasn't very long ago at all, ladies and gentlemen. It was about 1992, I believe. And he decided that he was going to do something that is almost impossible to do nowadays because of the proliferation of people everywhere. It wasn't too many years ago that you could do it, just about in most of the western states. But now it's pretty tough. He wanted to just take a horse and get away from everything. And I forgot to tell you that all of his life, Jeff has played the guitar and sang. And for several years, he was heavily involved with the Nashville music industry. And he played guitar and backup singer in quite a few of the very, very famous country and western bands, and with some of the most famous country and western singers. But Jeff had to leave that scene, as he calls it, because it wasn't healthy. As he sat one night by the campfire, just he and I late at night, and he told me about the corruption and the narcotics and the payoffs that have to be made just to get a record to even start to go anywhere. And the wasted talent, and mainly because they don't have the money to do it. But he left. He went to the Paradise Valley of Nevada, and it just seems he couldn't get away from everybody far enough. So he purchased three Arabian horses. He had a dog named Carlos, and which was a golden retriever. And he loaded his horses up with just the bare necessities that he would need, a pistol and a rifle, and he and his dog and the three horses set out to cover as much ground as possible over the next 9 or 10 months without relying upon society or even coming across society as much as, you know, he could possibly prevent it. And he lived and rode and camped and just like the old settlers of the Old West. I shouldn't say old settlers of the Old West. A lot of them were pretty young. And Jeff learned a lot during that trip about himself, about his horses, about his dog, about life in general, about living on the land, about finding water when there wasn't any, and learning to rely upon his dog Carlos and his three horses to sort of sense in which direction water lay. Well, Jeff ended up in Sedona, Arizona, after his long ride across Nevada through the state of Utah, portions of Colorado, down across northern Arizona and through the Grand Canyon, staying away from all contact with people during all that time. And as I said, ended up in Sedona, Arizona. At that time, I was living in Camp Verde. And I remember everybody talking to the crazy cowboy that came into town, all scroungy and dirty and just with three horses and a dog, who set up a teepee and was living in a teepee and teaching horseback riding. Well, Jeff saved his money. He made a trip one time to the White Mountains and noticed how absolutely beautiful that it is where we live here, and purchased some land from a bank that didn't even know they owned the land and wanted to get rid of it real quick because there was no access to the property. But Jeff is a visionary. He's a dreamer. He saw the potential of the land, and he knew that by talking with the neighbors and making deals and trades and just being a good neighbor, that he could get access to the land. And when he first settled on his new property, all he had was a wagon, his three horses, his dog Carlos, and the first thing that he built was a large fire ring with the volcanic rock that was found there, and in fact can be found all over the White Mountains. Jeff began to plan his ranch. The only access at that time was horseback, and he was there summer and winter through the deep snow, and began building by going out and bringing the wood in on wagon drawn by horses. There were no roads. He didn't have any legal access, and everybody told him that he couldn't build anything there. But I've got to tell you, folks, if you've never seen the ranch, you've got to go look at it because it is magnificent. And it's all been built by Jeff and a few loyal, trusting, and good friends. He's battled planning commissions and forest rangers and crotchety neighbors and everything that you can think of to make his dream come true. And it is beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been, one of the most relaxing places. Jeff, when he opens the door to you, he opens the door to you. It's as if it were your own home. And you can bring your horses out and ride them there, or you can ride Jeff's horses, or you can take long hikes or do anything that you want to do. Literally, it's a wonderful, beautiful place to go, and that's where we had our conference. And spent some time on the firing range with all of our people who came. Everybody went horseback riding. Michael Cottingham was there, who, well, I'll talk about that, and I'll get into the particulars of what we did day by day. And if you missed it, I'm so sorry, because you should have been there. It was one of the most incredible learning experiences, relaxing times. And of course, everybody who comes to our conferences are the best people that you could ever imagine ever meeting in your entire life. Well, you know, everything I was telling you before was from my heart, and I just picked up the brochure, and here's the whole story. So I'm going to read this to you so that you can get a little better picture, because I'm sure I left some things out, and probably a lot, I don't know, but we'll find out. Here's the official story of the ranch. Thunder Horse Ranch was built by Jeff Duvall and a handful of determined friends and family. Duvall arrived in Arizona on horseback. His ride was to take him to Quintana Roo territory in the southern reaches of Mexico, but when he encountered the White Mountains of Arizona, Mexico was soon forgotten. His entourage included his Arabian stallion Pohono, that's the one that I told you that Pooh is riding now, his two Arabian mares, Christomir and Whitefeather, and his dog Carlos. And by the way, folks, if you do make it over there, don't say anything about Carlos. Carlos just died about 2.5 months ago of cancer. And one day he was just a healthy, robust, wonderful dog, the best friend that that Jeff ever had. And the next day he was dead, and he had massive tumors in his throat. So I would appreciate if you go over to the ranch, you know, just forget that you ever heard about Carlos, because Jeff is still a little a little hurt by that. Before his expedition was over, he had ridden over 1,100 miles in every kind of weather, camping in temperatures ranging from 16 degrees below zero to 114 degrees Fahrenheit. He started his journey in Paradise Valley, Nevada, near the Oregon border. He traversed Nevada and Utah, stopping at remote ranches when he found himself in need of supplies. Other than that, he stayed away from civilization. He hunted for himself and Carlos as his horses foraged on wild grass. He crossed the narrow switchbacks of the Grand Canyon and continued south into the village of Oak Creek to rest his horses at Verde Valley School Stables. This whole journey took about 9 months. The school asked him to stay, and Jeffrey remained at the school as a faculty member and advisor, teaching equestrian studies and guitar. And his abode, which was a real Indian teepee where he lived, next to the corrals, became famous far and wide. After a trip to the White Mountains, Duvall found himself pondering the idea of his long-envisioned dream, a wilderness camp for children. The setting was ideal. After short deliberation, plans were in effect, and the building of Thunder Horse began. Now, Thunder Horse Ranch was built with a specific purpose in mind. It was built during raging monsoons and heavy snowfall. Access by motor vehicle was impossible without a road during the beginning stages of construction, and much of the lumber and building supplies were hauled in by horse and wagon, and as Jeff puts it, proving once again that the horse will always prevail over machines, and in the long run, we might find out that he may be right. Thunder Horse Ranch was designed to provide an educational, fun-filled environment for visitors of all ages. The most rewarding aspects of this beautiful ranch are found in the children camps for the needy and less fortunate. And many of these camps I've gone over to help Jeff, and sometimes, you know, whatever he needed me to do, and it's always been a lot of fun. All of the children camps provide a sound reason for developing academic skills. Through carpentry and woodworking, the children turn math into a hobby. The study of horse breeds gives geography and world history a new life. Children learn about cultures and continents in a way never explored by most. And of course, animal husbandry and forestry highlight the importance of our Earth's miraculous yet delicate ecosystem. In a world driven by television, fax machines, computers, and cellular phones, everybody at Thunder Horse Ranch has chosen a much simpler path. And by golly, if you go out there and visit, you'll find that out real quick. And if you go around looking for a television to watch or phones to use, you're not going to find them, folks, because that's not the purpose of the ranch. All answers, if you look hard enough, can be found in nature. A search, if you will, for the important yet simple natural things in life. And, you know, this is not a commercial by any means. I'm just setting the stage for our annual conference that we hold for our members of the Intelligence Service, CAGI News Service, and our Veritas reporters, all of the people around the world who help us in what we do, collecting, evaluating, and disseminating information to all peoples, of all races, all religions, all places of ancestral origin, in the interest of preserving freedom for this country and for the world. And when I say and for the world, I'm not kidding, folks. If we lose it here, the whole world is going to go backwards into enslavement, just like the human race has been held enslaved throughout most of its history. On Sunday, we headed on over just to, because we had two trucks full of equipment and audio and visual supplies and camcorders and the videotaping equipment and, you know, our personal belongings that we needed to last through the week, and our two children got established in our cabin. There's two cabins on the ranch, and we took one of the cabins. Everyone else either camped out on the ranch, brought their own tents and camping gear, or they stayed in the bunkhouses. There are beds for 40 people in the bunkhouses, and we had three meals a day, beginning Sunday night with a wonderful supper, and then again beginning Monday morning when registration began from 9 until noon. We had a great breakfast and then lunch, and every day we were fed with tremendous amounts of food, delicious, wonderful food. Some of it grilled outside on the oak coals and smoked. Some of it cooked in the kitchen, depending upon what we had. All of it was delicious. And beginning at 1:30 on that Monday, I was on first and talked about the limits of federal jurisdiction, the status of state citizens, talked about the need for federal officers to have and be able to present delegations of authority, giving them the lawful authority to do what they do, and the responsibility of all citizens of the states to demand that the federal government hold its agents, officers, and agencies to the limits of the jurisdiction of the federal government by requiring that they produce the lawful authority and proof of such to engage in the activities that they are engaging in, most of which are unlawful and dangerous, and documented it with Supreme Court cases, United States District Court cases, appellate court cases, etc., etc., state court cases, from the beginning of the country right up to the present time. We documented the delegation of authority orders issued by the Department of the Treasury. We talked about executive orders issued by the President. We talked about where the authority for executive orders came from. And I gave everyone about 120 some odd pages of legal cites and legal briefs so that they would have that information as they go out into the world. And everyone was just absolutely amazed when they found out the truth, and not dictated by me, folks, dictated by the courts, about the unlawfulness of most activities of federal agents, federal agencies, federal officers, special agents, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Internal Revenue Service, all of these. And at the end, the last thing that I did was expose the lack of authority over anyone by the Criminal Investigation Division of the Internal Revenue Service and their lack of authority to investigate or prosecute anyone who is a citizen of any of the states. In fact, the federal jurisdiction is so limited, ladies and gentlemen, that the Internal Revenue Service had to enter into special agreements, which are treaties, with the states, which are null and void upon their inception because the states are forbidden by the Constitution of the United States of America to enter into treaties with anyone, even the federal government. They've had to enter into special treaties with each individual state just to be able to require their own employees to file and pay income tax. And of course, they extend this to the other citizens of the states through fraud, coercion, fear, and just plain outright extortion and lies. It is, in fact, criminal. And anyway, that pretty much took care of Monday. Tuesday. Oh, my goodness. What happened on Tuesday? I don't even remember, to tell you the truth, what happened Tuesday morning, except that the whole week went like that. We had a plethora of speakers. Michael Cottingham came from New Mexico, who is one of the nation's preeminent nutritionists and herbalists. And, of course, he took everybody on plant walks and showed them how to identify the various plants that they could use to eat if they ran out of food, or to supplement the nutritional value of the food that they eat today, wherever they're at, how to pick plants and prepare them as potions, unguents, salves, teas, medicines to be used by families in their own health regimen, which plants had which vitamins, and which plants were good for relief of pain. For instance, not many of you know probably that the bark of the aspen tree is stronger than any pain reliever that you can buy in any drugstore. Has absolutely no side effects. It tastes a little bitter, but if you get some aspen bark and you're in pain, instead of taking aspirin, which does have some pretty bad side effects, or Tylenol or ibuprofen or any of those, because they all, I don't care what you call them, Advil, they all have bad side effects. Well, the bark of the aspen tree has no bad side effects. It's just a little bitter tasting. And if you chew that bark, your pain will go away faster and stay away longer than if you were taking hand loads of pills that will destroy your liver and your stomach and who knows what else in your body. That's just one of the things that people learned. In fact, Michael lectured and talked and answered questions and took people on herb walks and plant identification walks all the time that he was there for 3 days. And one entire day, from the time everyone finished breakfast until late into the night, was dedicated solely to his presentations and teaching. So, you know, you missed out. Jay was here from Arkansas, and Jay is quite the farmer, and he knows how, ladies and gentlemen, to grow literally anything, how to improve the soil. He spoke for quite a few hours and taught people how to prepare the soil, and that's any kind of soil. From the very worst to the very best, he taught them how to improve it, how to prepare it, how to plant, how to maintain the crops, when to water, how to know when the plants needed water, what to do to protect plants in areas with a strong wind, and how to harvest the crop, prepare the harvested crop for storage for canning, and how to can, and the whole bit all the way through. Was an incredible experience. Everybody learned an awful lot, and they're not likely to forget it. Bob Swan, my oldest and dearest friend, was there who spent many hours teaching people about trusts, constitutional contractual trusts, and what they're for, how they work, how they can protect you. If they're for you, how to get into one. If they're not for you, then you know, certainly don't need one. But it was an eye opener for a lot of people, folks. And the whole week was like that. It just, you know, went from day to day, and hour to hour, and lecture to lecture, and we had an incredible time, just an incredible time. And every night, everyone would sit around the campfire and we'd sing songs or, you know, just talk way into the wee hours of the morning. Jeff would play his guitar and sing, and we just had such a great time. And I feel so tremendously lucky to know such wonderful people. But that's the kind of people that our cause attracts. Serious, good, sincere, polite, moral, God-fearing people. And those are the kind of people that I love to be around. Melissa Udall was our hostess for the conference, and I want to thank her for making sure that everyone's needs were met and taking care of the problems as they arose in such a fast and proficient and helpful manner. And she enjoyed the week also. I want to thank Nolan Udall for coming out and talking to everyone for an hour. And she enjoyed the week also. I want to thank Nolan Udall for coming out and talking to everyone for an hour about his venture into long-distance telephone land, of which we are involved in an effort to help support our endeavors, so to speak. Well, one of which is Veritas newspaper. And by the way, Veritas issue number 16 is in the mail. Did you hear that? Veritas issue number 16 is in the mail. The headline story, U.S. plans world police force. And as usual, folks, we document it. It's all documented. In fact, the United States State Department wrote the headline story. It is, in fact, State Department Publication 7277, verbatim, just exactly as published by the United States Printing Office. And it will blow your mind. As usual, I will take a big pile of these down to Glenn Jacobs, who can either stick them in his newspaper, or you can just drop by Glenn's house and pick one up for free. Also on the first page is a story about the Georgia Guidestones and another story about House Resolution 3130, which imposes mandatory Social Security number requirements upon the states, and that they're telling the states that they can't give you any services whatsoever, not even a driver's license, not anything, nothing, unless you furnish them with a Social Security number. But the federal government has no authority to do that, to demand that the states do that, nor do the states have the authority to demand that the citizens do it. Because we'll talk about it on another broadcast. Not something I want to get into right this moment. So, if you'll bear with me, I'm going to take a little break so that I can take a sip of water here, and I'll be right back after this very brief pause.
Sweet angel time, it's just a habit I've got. You You drive me wild. Crazy people, crazy people. Drive the people, drive the people. Drive the people like you. Go crazy over people like you. Wow. Wow. Wow, wow, wow.
You know, folks, Michael Cunningham writes a column for our newspaper. And in the May issue of Veritas, he called it Plants and People, Herbal First Aid Bleeding. His column was on bleeding, how to use plants and the things that you find growing out in your yard, in most cases, to take care of your health. May was How to Stop Bleeding. And June's issue, number 16, which is in the mail now, or is in the process of part in the mail, part going in the mail, it's his column is on milk thistle and liver health. Milk thistle is something that grows wild everywhere. Most people think it's a noxious, terrible weed. If they just understood that most plants have either a tremendous nutritional or medicinal value and can be used to keep you out of trouble. I take milk thistle every day, ladies and gentlemen, twice a day, as a matter of fact, and just to keep my liver healthy and functioning properly and cleaned out, and by golly, it really works. You know, Miles Gilbert, one of the local residents in the Round Valley, was at our conference. He gave a tremendously educating and informative and humorous, Miles is a pretty funny guy, talk about the ancient Indian cultures and the ruins and archaeological sites that are in this area. And he brought a lot of slides and showed us pictures of the pictographs and the ruins and the sites that he has helped discover or helped to excavate or helped in some way with providing or with determining, you know, what happened really at those places. And when, and by who, and how many years ago, and all of those things. And lo and behold, almost every one of them were within a mile and a half to 7 miles from my house. And some of them are just incredible, and I have never even seen most of them. So I'm going to make it a point to visit every one of them, and see them, and learn about them, because they're just incredible. And he talked about what they, you know, the records that they really left that are on the stones, the rock paintings, as some people call them, or where they have chipped away the patina of the rock to leave pictures and, in fact, messages. And lo and behold, that all of these symbols that on television, you see some weirdo guy standing there who claims to have all kinds of credentials telling us that these symbols are the records of spacecraft that visited the Earth thousands of years ago and the records of interaction between the ancient Indian cultures and extraterrestrial visitors just simply aren't anything of the kind. When you're talking to a real archaeologist, not one of these phony New Age quack dudes that want to promote the ufology movement, and they show you the exact same symbols and explain to you the true meaning, which Miles did for us, and I'm deeply indebted to him for that, you get an entirely different picture, an entirely different story, and in fact, you don't get any record of any kind of extraterrestrial visitation from anybody, from anywhere whatsoever. The messages were usually simple and had to do with survival or identification or marking territory or the identification of the secret societies that the Indians belonged to. And That is extremely interesting. The truth is always better than the lie or the fiction, although sometimes the lie or the fiction may be interesting. It is certainly not good. So Miles did that for us. We also went to the there's a little range by the ranch. We went to the range, and I gave a class on pistol shooting and basic rifleman marksmanship, I should say. And then everybody took turns, and I kept my nose out of their business except to make sure that the range was safe and that everybody had a good time, and they really did. Miles, on the way to the ranch to give his talk, saw us at the rifle range, and true to form, he had in his car a buffalo rifle, a reproduction of an old Sharps buffalo rifle, falling block, breech loading, and he had his pistol with him. And my friend Bob Swan had a fantastic, beautiful 30-06 rifle with him. And we all got to fire a couple of rounds of ammo through Miles's buffalo rifle. And I got to tell you, that was a lot of fun. And very extremely powerful and very heavy. The rifle itself weighed 12 pounds. It's not something that you enjoy shooting offhand with. And, of course, would explain why in the old drawings of the buffalo hunters, you either saw them lying in the prone position with their rifle resting upon a berm of earth or some rocks, or on one of those poles that you stick in the ground that has the little, you know, the horseshoe-shaped top to it where you rest your barrel. Or just in some cases, I've seen pictures, artist rendition of buffalo hunters using a forked stick in which to rest the rifle. Heavy, heavy weapons. Big, giant, thick barrel. And these, you know, have to be hefted by big, strong people if you're going to shoot off any what's known as the offhand position or standing position, without any rest for the rifle. I'm used to shooting big, heavy rifles, and that rifle was heavy for me. I'm a big man. And it was heavy for everybody. It's heavy for Miles. The best way to fire that rifle was, of course, in a sitting position using your knees as support, like you learned in basic training. Or as the old buffalo hunters did, lying behind a berm of earth and resting the stock on the little mound of dirt directly in front of him. Let me go through the rest of the paper. We have a letter written by the Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. It's quite a letter. My friend Aaron Zellman, who is the director of that organization, does not mince words. And he knows why the Jews were persecuted in Europe. For some reason, the rabbis and the leaders of the Jewish community always tells the Jewish people that they aren't supposed to own guns, that they cannot own guns, that they should not form militias, that they should not ever engage in any kind of defense or violence or anything like that. Well, a lot of Jews are waking up, and they're understanding, you know, what that's all about. That's a method of controlling people. And you've got to understand that if the Jews in Europe had formed strong militias with the other people who formed the underground, they wouldn't have gone to concentration camps. They would not have been slaughtered in large numbers. And they would not have been forced into ghettos or made to wear those silly-looking yellow stars on their clothing. That just would not have happened, ladies and gentlemen. And Hitler probably would not have been able to come to power. And Aaron Zellman is one of the leaders of the Jewish community who understands that, and he formed Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. He has documented throughout history that whenever any people have ever been disarmed, they have shortly thereafter either been enslaved or completely killed off, genocide. And he doesn't just stand up and say it. He's like me. He documents it. He documents it. Also, Agenda 21, which is the companion piece in this issue to the last issue, which one of the headline stories was Border Region 21. And I discussed a little bit about that on this broadcast when I told you about issue number 15 of Veritas. Veritas, of course, is Latin for truth. It's a full-size national newspaper. It goes to everybody in Washington, D.C., every issue. And I understand the bureaucracy there tries to intercept the issues before any of the congressmen or senators or agency heads get it and of course, destroy it. But we keep sending them, and occasionally some of them get through. Veritas means truth. And this is the only newspaper in the whole United States where you don't get pablum, you don't get lies, you don't get agendas, you get truth. It tells the truth, folks. And it's pretty hard to gather the information, analyze it, put it together, and make sure it's the truth. Truth is elusive at best. And, of course, nobody today wants anybody to know about it. There's an article in here on Congressman Ron Paul, who's the Honorable Ron Paul Member of Congress from the 14th District of Texas, who's being leaned on by his fellow congressman because he is getting at the real root of the problems in this country and trying to do something about it. And they'd sure rather that he wasn't in Congress. I can tell you that. An article on Big Brother's Watching, how employers all across the world, and this is a story that came out of London, are putting video cameras in toilet bathroom stalls to spy on their employees. Can you believe that? I wonder who's sitting there watching you when you go in and pull down your pants and sit on the toilet. I just wonder how they find people who are willing to do that kind of work. It's beyond my understanding. Some very good cartoons in Veritas, folks. There's an article on the bank crises policies. It's a speech given by Chairman Alan Greenspan before the 34th Annual Conference on Bank Structure and Competition of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. Of course, Michael's column. There is a blurb on Oklahoma City Day One by Michelle Marie Moore. Since nobody was buying the book at the price that we needed to sell it at in order to make back our money, we're just giving it away. And I'm not going to let it sit in the warehouse. People need to read it. So we're just giving it away. Every time somebody orders a 12-issue subscription of Veritas, we give them that $35 book, ladies and gentlemen. Just give it to them. And, of course, in this issue is the last and final, the third and final installment or printing of the public notice, which fulfills the requirement of the law in busting the fraudulent agency which administers the fraudulent so-called income tax, the so-called Internal Revenue Service, which is not an agency of the United States government or the Treasury Department at all. We have discovered and documented it and proved it. There's also a whole page on the complex trust in here, just like there was in the last issue, because so many people need that. We're going to continue it. And, of course, we're taking advertising for Veritas. You can get the rate sheet off the Internet. In the next issue of Veritas, the rate sheet will be in it. And the rates are really low, ladies and gentlemen. This is a national newspaper. And you can get a full-page ad for, I think, about $200, if I'm not mistaken. I'd have to go and check on the website, but it, you know, if it's not $200, it's right around that amount. We got a lot of back issues available also. It's an incredible paper. Just an incredible newspaper. And it's put together by people just like you who got sick of reading lies. And basically, I instigated the whole thing simply because somebody told me I couldn't do it. And since nobody else was printing a paper that told the truth, I decided we were going to do it. Just like this radio station. We're doing it. And everything else that we do, we're doing it. Publishing books that nobody else will publish. Simply to help educate the American people so that they don't have to relegate their children, their posterity, to slavery. It's a terrible thing that a lot of Americans are doing now, negating the tremendous sacrifices and losses that the founding fathers and all of the other people who have gone before, who gave their lives, lost their property and their families and their health and limbs, to give their posterity, which is us, the freedom that they created and enjoyed. And here we are. Oh, here we are. Oh, great Americans. Oh, yeah. Listen to some of the sheeple talk. They were think they were God's gift to the universe. Giving it all back. Reaching down and putting the chains around their own ankles willingly. Getting ready to march right back into slavery. Shame. Shame, shame, shame. Tremendous shame. Well, don't go away. I've got to wet my throat a little bit here before I start coughing. You know how this dry early summer is, folks, and it's starting to get to my throat. So hang on. I'll be right back. Well, today's broadcast was live. Tomorrow and Wednesday, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to continue with the series on UFOs that we began last week. You heard part one and part two on Thursday and Friday. I'm sorry, it wasn't last week. It was the week before last, before the conference began. You heard part one and part two on the Thursday and Friday week before last. And you're going to hear part three tomorrow and part four on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, you'll hear another live broadcast of the Hour of the Time. So I want to make sure that everybody knows what they're going to be hearing so that if you don't want to listen to it, you don't have to tune in. And if you do want to listen to it, it'll be here. I find the subject absolutely engrossing, interesting. And the truth is that it's all a scam. There may be extraterrestrials out there, but what you're seeing is the ufology movement. And if you get involved in really believing all of this crapola without any proof whatsoever, and there isn't, ladies and gentlemen, every bit of it can be absolutely dissected and destroyed with any keen mind on the planet. And if you fall for it without using any of your cognitive reasoning power, then the ufology movement has made you the fool. But anyway, it's still interesting. It's like a good story. It's like a bedtime story. You know it's fiction, and you could listen to it and enjoy it. If you don't know it's fiction, it could really do quite a bit of harm. It could even be helping to enslave the American people and bring on world government, for your information. Anyway, be that as it may, I will be here tomorrow to give you part three of that series, and on Wednesday, part four, and I will be back here at the microphone on Thursday to bring you another live episode of The Hour of the Time. I want to thank everybody who came to the conference and made it such a wonderful event. And be watching your mailbox for issue number 16. It's out, folks. Good night, and God bless each and every single one of you. And remember, folks, as you go about your daily chores, there is no such thing as the lesser of two evils. A deal with the devil is still a deal with the devil. Figuratively speaking, of course. Don't give in to temptation, folks, just because one bad choice is less bad than the other. Do what is right. We must all begin to live our lives in truth, by the truth, and by what is right. Not doing that is what got us to this point in history. Listening to 101.1 FM Eager, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM Eager is your non-profit community service radio station.